Welcome to the Gastroenterology Podcast for February 2012, hosted by Journal Online editor Dr. John F. Kemmerly, Professor of Medicine and Physiology at the Medical College of Virginia campus of Virginia Commonwealth University. Each month, this podcast features a wide range of information and opinion from experts and authors of recent articles from gastroenterology, the official journal of the AGA Institute, and the most prominent journal in the field of gastrointestinal disease. We'll also be bringing you highlights of important stories from the latest issue of the AGA's official newspaper, GI and Hepatology News. But first, Dr. Kemmerly speaks to the author of a paper on detection of colorectal cancer and large adenomas with next-generation stool DNA test. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, this is Jay Kemmerly. Colorectal cancer remains the number two cancer in terms of mortality in the United States. In order to deliver the maximum benefit, however, a colorectal cancer screening tool must detect both curable stage colorectal cancers as well as precursor lesions arising throughout the colon and rectum, and also be accepted by patients and be cost-effective. No conventional screening tool meets these desired goals at present. One alternative strategy that has potential to improve colorectal cancer screening is stool DNA testing. Joining me today to discuss this topic and his article appearing in the February issue of Gastroenterology, entitled Next Generation Stool DNA Test Accurately Detects Colorectal Cancer and Large Adenomas, is Dr. David Alquist, Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Alquist, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
To start off, can you outline the concerns with colorectal cancer screening for our listeners?
I think in your opening remarks, Jay, you gave a good contextual background to that response. The scientific and clinical audience reading this journal is mindful of the beneficial impact of screening interventions on cancer outcomes and the trend of reduced cancer incidence in this country suggest that cancer screening has had an impact. However, I think the audience also understands that the arrows in our current screening quiver all fall short of the ideal mark of non-invasiveness, no preparation, no diet or medication restrictions, and high sensitivity for cancer and, as you mentioned, precancers. So as long as there's room for improvement, there's a mandate to continue to improve what we're currently doing and to innovate with new tools. Now, stool DNA testing has been around for a while, but the initial tests were hampered by technical issues rather than biological limitations. And most of those technical issues have been resolved with methodologic advancements over the past half decade or so. So it's a new generation of tests, and I'll just summarize a few of those advances being use of a preservative buffer at the time of stool collection to prevent DNA degradation during transfer and storage, better capture of markers from stool, better markers that are now broadly informative and cover essentially all of the bases of cancer and precancers at the tissue level, much higher analytical sensitivity, up to three orders of magnitude now compared to first-generation tests, to name a few. So with that as a background, that prompted the study that we've recently had published in Gastroenterology.
David, could you explain for our listeners how you and your colleagues constructed that study about using this next generation test that you've described?
Sure. Well, it was a convenience sample in many ways, in that it exploited existing freezer archives in academic centers around the world: Denmark, Johns Hopkins, Toronto, Mayo Clinic. And what was unique about these archives is that they were all stools collected in preservative buffer. And that yielded a fairly large sample for us to do a case control analysis. There were 253 colorectal cancers 130 advanced adenomas and just shy of 300 patients with normal colonoscopy findings. The study was designed as a training and test and set sort of design where we optimized the assay and marker cutoffs in the training set and then did a test set. Because the sample size was so large, we looked at the combined data to do a covariate analysis, and it was those findings that in many ways were the most enlightening.
So with that sophisticated analysis that you did with this study, what did you find?
Yeah, well, just the basic results from the training and test sets, and I might add that the training set was done at Exact Sciences, who was the industry collaborator on this, and the test set was done at Mayo Medical Labs, so separate laboratories. In the test set, the cancer detection rate was 88.8% across all stages, and 64% for adenomas larger than 1 centimeter. In the test set, using the cutoffs identified, the sensitivity for cancer fell somewhat to 78%, but the precancer detection rate held exactly at 64%. So we used the overall or combined samples to do the covariate analyses, and in that combined set, the overall sensitivity was 85% for cancer and 64% for precancer. Now, as I mentioned, the covariate analyses were very revealing. First of all, looking at cancer stage, the cancer stages 1 through 3 were equally high. There were no statistically significant differences between stage 1, 2, or 3 cancers, and the aggregate sensitivity for those more curable stage cancers was 87%. And a very important finding, maybe the centrally important finding in the study, was the effect of adenoma size on detection rates. As we all know, as adenomas increase, the risk of cancer progression increases proportionately. And so the largest polyps are those at greatest risk. Polyp size is a continuum, and we sort of use 1 centimeter as a cutoff point in that continuum for defining advanced adenomas. Well, if one takes all adenomas larger than 1 centimeter, the detection rate was 64%, but larger than 2 centimeters, 79%, and larger than 3 centimeters, 91%. So, and this is biologically rational. As the surface area increases, so does the amount of cell shedding or exfoliation and the positivity rate with a DNA-based assay. Those sorts of findings have huge implications on a longitudinal screening program where if you miss a lesion the first round, on subsequent rounds, one has a good chance of picking up the most aggressive lesions, and the aggregate sensitivity over a period of time could be very high and compare favorably with a test like colonoscopy, which is done every 10 years. And I think for perspective, that is important because a cervical pap smear, which has virtually eliminated cervical cancer in those who are screened regularly, has a sensitivity for precancerous dysplasia of only 50%. So if you start at a sensitivity of 64% and apply that repetitively, I'm optimistic that one could achieve the same sorts of outcomes at a population level with a test like this.
Overall, the stool test performed very well, but I also think there's some noteworthy findings within your results that are worth talking about. For instance, not only did you've described something about the size of the lesions and the cancer stage it detected, but also it performed very well in identifying lesions throughout the colon and rectum, particularly in the right colon where it's important, where we know colonoscopy is somewhat less effective.
Oh, right. I'm glad you mentioned that. That's a centrally important finding, especially if one considers that really all of our current screening modalities, including colonoscopy, are biased toward the detection of left-sided disease. Now, we, as gastroenterologists, think that colonoscopy can be dramatically improved by training ourselves to detect these flat, serrated lesions on the right colon. But nevertheless, it was very encouraging to see the results of this study, which show for both adenomas and for cancers, there was no difference in detection rates between proximally located and distally located neoplasms.
Another piece that jumps out at me is, as you've already described, it did very well at identifying stage 1, 2, and 3 cancers, but it fell off somewhat with stage 4. And I think it's important to think about, as since this test looks at methylation status in a higher level hypomethylated lesion, you have to be cautious with the results.
Yeah, I mean, we can only speculate on why the sensitivity rate fell a bit with stage 4 disease. The detection rate for all stage 4 cancers was 69%. One can speculate that it may be a trend toward hypomethylation, and we potentially lost some of the methylation markers. That remains to be proven. Also, it's possible that the more necrotic the tumor is, that you lose, which would be true with a very advanced lesion, you can actually lose viable surface area from the luminal side. But having said all that, we did report another study this November in an abstract form and with a different patient group. We did not see a drop-off in that study with stage 4 disease. It was equally high. This may have been a phenomenon of sample and non-representativeness of that particular cohort. It's an interesting observation. I think more studies need to be done to see if that holds. But I think bottom line is stage 4 disease is not really a screening target.
Hopefully that's something, though, in a longitudinal patient experience would be avoided way before you reach that point.
I totally agree.
Perhaps you could compare some of the other DNA tests and how you feel they perform compared to stool. And I'm thinking about blood-based or plasma-based DNA testing.
Sure. We recently did a comparison study head-to-head on paired samples, plasma and stool, between the stool DNA test used in this gastroenterology study and the plasma septin-9 assay, which is, the, as far as I know, the only plasma-based DNA test that is commercially available. And to not get into all the details of that, but just to get right to the results, the adenoma detection rate, and these were large adenomas, was 82% by the stool DNA test and 14% by the plasma septin-9 test. And that 14% was no difference than the background, false positive rate for the plasma septin-9 test. So it did not detect these precursor lesions in contrast to the stool DNA test. And biologically, those were the results that we expected. Precancers exfoliate abundantly into the lumen before they invade the basement membrane and blood vessels. By definition, a precancer is non-invasive, and one can question how do markers get into the blood if there's no direct contact with the vascular system. We did know for cancers in that comparison study that as stage progressed, the plasma septin-9 test became increasingly positive. So by stage 4 disease, there was no statistically significant difference between the tests. But for stage 1 through 3, the stool DNA test was quite a bit more sensitive, 90% for the stool DNA test versus 50% for the plasma test on stages 1 through 3 disease. So we have direct information on that particular test in comparison. There are a number of other tests under development, some of them protein-based, some of them RNA-based, RNA expression markers in circulating white cells. But there really is what we lack at this point is peer-reviewed data and or corroborative data. So it's I think we're in a speculation sort of time frame with the evolving tests, but they really merit tracking, I would say.
David, what do you think you would like to do next to move at least stool-based DNA testing along to fruition?
Well, you know, these the results that we observed in the gastro enterology paper were very promising, and we feel that it's an imperative to move forward and do the right next test to corroborate these results in the screening setting, so that once done, we can make the appropriate move toward offering the test to patients. Now, this such a study is in fact underway. Exact Sciences has launched a multi-center study for FDA approval targeting average risk individuals across more than 50 centers in this country and in Canada. And that study is should be concluded by the end of 2012, so end of this year, with FDA review and hopeful approval early in 2013. That study will define sensitivity and specificity for cancer and precancers in against gold standard colonoscopy, and will also compare stool results with that of a commercial FIT test. So there'll be a comparison in stool testing and a definition of sensitivity and specificity against colonoscopy.
In closing, is there a take-home message you'd like our listeners to have?
Yeah, you know, I think we have to keep an open mind as a profession to doing the right thing and to do it as well as possible. And at the end of the day, however well this test works, it's a positive test is only as good as the quality of the follow-up colonoscopy. It's in everybody's interest to continue to our efforts to improve colonoscopy. If this test was broadly applied in the population, especially pulling in individuals who are currently not being screened, my sense is that the colonoscopy volumes are going to potentially increase rather than decrease as a result of a test like this. And it will require ongoing, close, collaborative discussions to accomplish this sort of screening paradigm change. So I would leave it at that.
Thank you very much for joining us on air today, both to share your expert insight as well as the exciting results of your paper appearing in the February issue of Gastroenterology.
Pleasure, and thank you for your interest.
You can find this paper on gastrojournal.org or in the print edition of the February issue. Now here are some top stories from the latest issue of GI and Hepatology News, the official newspaper of the AGA. A treatment called islet cell transplantation can be effective and safe for chronic pancreatitis pain, with survival rates over 85% at 5 years, researchers said at the annual meeting of the Southern Surgical Association. One expert commenter, however, said that this radical approach is irreversible and can cause serious complications. The treatment involves removing the entire pancreas, obtaining islet cells from it, and infusing the cells into the liver. Patients with irritable bowel syndrome may respond to a novel approach called the low FODMAP diet. This diet is low in various types of sugars, such as fermentable sugars, that can be problematic because they pull fluid into the intestines, causing bloating and pain in people with IBS. An Australian study found that 86% of patients on the low FODMAP diet had improved symptoms versus 49% of those on a standard diet. The data were presented at the annual meeting of the American College of Gastroenterology. Also at the American College of Gastroenterology annual meeting, investigators reported on prevention of colorectal cancer in Medicare patients. The large retrospective study included almost 60,000 patients. It found that compared with no screening, colonoscopy significantly reduced cancers in both the distal colon and proximal colon. This finding was important because recent research suggested that colonoscopy might not prevent cancer effectively in the proximal colon. An antitoxin drug called N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, failed to improve survival of patients with severe alcoholic hepatitis, researchers wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine. NAC was combined with another drug, prednisolone, but the combination was no better than prednisolone by itself. The primary endpoint was mortality at 6 months, which did not differ significantly between the two groups. However, the authors said the study of 174 patients may have been too small to detect a true difference. For more in-depth information on these and other stories, please visit the newspaper online at gastro.org/GIHepNews. We hope you found this month's news and discussion enjoyable and informative. Feel free to send comments and feedback to gastropodcast@gastro.org. And please join us next month for more information on the latest research from gastroenterology. Thank you for listening.